everybody. Who's got good morning in another language for us? Sorry? Aaron Sosli. Yeah. It's not as good as the super morning. Aaron Sosli. I don't know. Is that Thai?
Cambodian.
Wow, you're from Cambodia. Incredible. Fantastic. All right. Aaron Sosli. No. Whatever you say sounds much funnier in his language, I'm sure. Okay, so today we're going to discuss gravitational waves. And and gravitational radiation. And as I mentioned last time, people have been talking about this for, well, almost 80 years, or 90 years. No, nearly 100 years, actually, right? Because Einstein's paper was 1915, his first paper on GR. And this came soon after. So people have been talking about it for 100 years, and we're going to see it. Okay, so we're the lucky ones. So the existence of these waves was hardly a surprise. Einstein copied his theory from Maxwell. And so this was not really a surprise, but nevertheless, much more complicated, much more interesting. And there are some very weird phenomena which happen in gravitational waves, which are still under discussion. I sent you all the link to the Hawking lecture on black holes, these BMS symmetries, something called the memory effect, and basically this new idea about where black hole information is stored is related to properties of gravitational radiation and the memory effect, that the gravitational waves sort of propagate a memory of whatever created them, and this memory is very rich and very interesting. We're not going to get into much of that, though I think next week you might have a problem set on it, if I can only compose a problem. But that's after we've done black holes. So for the moment, we're just going to do a very simple classic treatment of gravitational radiation. So it all starts with the vacuum Einstein equations. And by vacuum, I just mean there's no matter around. And I'm also going to ignore lambda, just to make life easy. Lambda is very small, even though it's positive. Let's ignore it. And so, of course, we have g mu nu equals 0. That's the Einstein equations, if there's no matter around. And we're going to discover, just like Maxwell discovered, that if he put all the electric currents to 0 and charges, he still got solutions. We're going to find some interesting solutions to this equation. And of course, this implies that r mu nu equals 0, right? Because this equation reads r mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu r equals 0. So therefore, r mu nu is 1 half g mu nu r. And now I can just take the trace of this equation. And it tells me that r equals, the trace of g is 4. So r is 2r. And so r is 0. Okay, so if g mu nu is 0, r is 0, and so r mu nu is 0. So it looks like nothing interesting so far, but we've got r mu nu is 0. So how do we calculate r mu nu? Well, we've got many times we've repeated the formula for the Riemann tensor at first order in H mu nu. So just take that formula. You're allowed to contract it using the eta, because we're only working to first order. And so when you do that, and I've even kept the indices the same, I believe, nu sigma rho sigma minus h rho nu comma sigma sigma minus h sigma sigma comma rho nu. That looks wrong. This should be a rho, I'm sorry. Minus h rho sigma comma sigma nu. Okay, so that's the, so to linear order in H. In H mu nu, we have this formula. Now this we can rewrite. There's a very nice term here, which is the one where the indices are contracted. So that's just a box, right? So eta sigma alpha d sigma d alpha is equal to d sigma d sigma d sigma. And that's just the Minkowski space box. Maybe I'll put a Minkowski M on it to indicate it's Minkowski. I don't want to do that. Let me just do that Minkowski box. So kind of the thing to do when you're doing linear theory, the thing to remember is that whenever you're doing linear theory, you're dealing with this H, the metric you use is eta. As long as you work into linear order, you use the metric eta. When you write down a box, it's with eta. When you raise and lower indices, it's with eta. Okay? That's just because we're dealing with linear quantities. Now, okay, so this term is nice. This is minus box H rho sigma, rho sigma. And then we've got some extra terms, and I'll show you how to reorganize them. Nu sigma comma rho sigma plus H sigma rho comma nu sigma minus H sigma sigma rho nu. Now these you can combine into two very similar quantities. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let's raise this. Okay, so I just combined these two terms. The different one is this, where the two indices are contracted. So I put half of it in here. And I put half of it in there. Those two halves are equal because this is the partial derivatives commute, and then the first terms are those. And so remember, we had to pick a gauge in order to solve the equations. We know that. Let us pick harmonic gauge. That's the gauge in which gamma lambda mu nu g mu nu equals 0. And if you work this out to first order in H, it reads H sigma nu comma sigma equals 1/2 H sigma sigma comma nu. Okay, so that's a very important equation. Let's call that 1. And the language, the description of that gauge is to call it transverse trace reversed, right? Or TT gauge. Let me explain that a little bit. Trace reversed means I take H mu nu and I go to H bar mu nu, which is H mu nu minus 1/2 eta mu nu H lambda lambda. And why is that trace reversed? Well, if I take the trace of H bar, okay, the trace of H bar is this, H bar lambda lambda, which is H lambda lambda minus, and then the trace of eta is 4, so I get minus 2 H lambda lambda, so that's minus H lambda lambda. So H bar has the opposite trace to H, that's why it's called trace reversed. Transverse means that I take, so this means d mu of H bar mu nu equals 0. Or I can raise and lower the indices, d mu H bar mu nu, I just raise and lower with eta, remember, equals 0. And that's exactly this, this condition here. Because you know, if I write it out, I'm going to get d mu h mu nu minus when the d mu hits that eta. Eta with a raised index is just delta, so that'll give me minus del nu and h lambda lambda with a 1/2. Equals 0, which is exactly that equation there. Okay, so this gauge is called transverse trace reversed gauge. And if I pick that gauge, these extra terms both disappear. Okay, because both of them involve exactly this quantity. Here it's the rho derivative of this quantity with a new index. Here it's the new derivative of this quantity with the rho index. So in TT gauge, we have R mu nu is minus 1/2 box H mu nu. And let's put a TT in there, which indicates that the H is in TT gauge. So that makes life easy. And obviously, we get waves traveling at the speed of light, just as we did in electromagnetism. And the general solution can be written as follows. H mu nu of x alpha is equal to sum over k. K are the spatial components of the Fourier modes. So we imagine Fourier transforming in x. And obviously, if we Fourier transform x, this operator box becomes minus d naught squared minus k squared. Okay, and then we just have to solve the equation d naught squared equals k squared. Box equals zero implies, well, I'll write down in a second. This is epsilon mu nu of k e to the I k dot x plus the complex conjugate, because the solution is real, where k dot x is equal to k naught k dot x is actually k naught x naught minus k dot x, other way around, minus here plus there. I'm sorry, there's no minus there. K downstairs index, x with an upstairs index. K dot x is k mu x mu. It's this. But this, of course, is minus k naught x naught plus k dot x. And we have box equals 0 implies that k naught squared equals k squared. And so what we do is we say k naught is equal to the magnitude of k. The energy is the magnitude of the momentum. And in this formula, we have positive energy solutions here and negative energy solutions there. And we add the two together. Well, positive k naught solutions with e to the I k naught, e to the minus I k naught, in just a combination so that the answer is real. So this is the general solution of the equation, but subject to the gauge conditions, which are that formula one, which tells us, whenever we take a derivative of h, we can replace it with ik. Okay, so d mu goes to ik mu in this formula, and minus ik mu in the other formula. And so what we end up with is that, so 1 implies k mu epsilon mu nu equals 1 half k nu epsilon mu mu. So, whereas we start out here with a matrix for every wave vector. So, wave vector is some vector telling you the direction the wave is traveling in. That's this matrix. It looks like it has 10 numbers because it's a 4x4 symmetric matrix. But we see that it's constrained. These are four equations for it. So, it looks like it has 10 minus 6 free parameters. Sorry, 10 minus 4 equals 6 free parameters. That's quite a lot still. But it turns out we can, through further gauge transformations, we can remove 4 more of these. So there is a remaining gauge freedom. Okay, TT gauge is just like Lorentz gauge. It doesn't uniquely fix the A mu. It only fixes it up to harmonic functions. And you can see that immediately because harmonic gauge is defined like this. And if I change x to x plus epsilon, and epsilon is a harmonic function, it still satisfies harmonic gauge. So there is a remaining gauge freedom, which is x prime mu is x mu plus epsilon mu of x with box of epsilon mu equals zero. So that absolutely preserves the gauge condition. And we can check that because you remember h prime mu nu is h mu nu minus epsilon mu comma nu minus epsilon nu comma mu. This was the Lie derivative. Lie derivative with using epsilon. If I apply it to the metric, remember the Lie derivative changed the metric by this symmetric combination of covariant derivatives. But if epsilon is small and h is small, you can drop the connection terms in that formula, and this is to linear order in h and epsilon. This is nu comma nu. Notice this epsilon is not the same as that epsilon. This epsilon only has one index. This has two. So this epsilon is just the coordinate transformation. And then you can check that. So one, equation one, that TT condition, if I plug this in, well, on the left-hand side, I'm going to get minus epsilon sigma nu comma sigma, right? If H transforms in this way, I'm going to get this term minus epsilon nu comma sigma sigma. Okay, just plugging this formula in with mu equal to sigma, and this index should be raised, I guess. This one should also be raised. And then on the right-hand side of one transforms to minus epsilon sigma comma sigma nu, because I get two terms here, but they're both identical. Right, so H sigma sigma transforms with minus two epsilon sigma, like this, sigma sigma. And so you see what happens is that the ugly terms, if you like, these two terms cancel. And so one is still valid. So one is still valid if epsilon nu comma sigma sigma equals zero, i.e. box epsilon sigma equals zero. So it was obvious from this equation, this is just checking explicitly, that the transverse traceless condition is maintained if you do harmonic coordinate transformations. So let's choose. So we're free to do four more coordinate transformations. Okay, so whereas epsilon looked like it had 10 degrees of freedom, we applied the gauge condition, it came down to six. But now we can do four coordinate transformations still, and that'll bring it down to two. And that's the right number of degrees of freedom for a massless spin two wave equation. So let's choose epsilon mu to be equal to, and I'm going to put some I's in just to make the algebra a little neater. Okay. e to the I k dot x minus I c mu star of k e to the minus I k dot x then a harmonic coordinate transformation x prime mu to x mu plus epsilon mu takes takes epsilon mu nu of k to epsilon prime mu nu of k, which is epsilon mu nu of k plus k mu c nu of k minus, plus k nu c mu of k. Okay, so if I just plug this formula into there and look at how this polarization tensor epsilon mu gets transformed by the C's, then all that happens is that it changes by this combination. Okay, so we really have 10 minus 4 minus 4 equals 2 remaining gauge invariant massless waves. So let's see that explicitly. Let us choose k mu to, well, let's choose k to be in the z direction. Okay, so this is a trick usually used to understand the general solution of wave equations and gauge conditions, is let's consider a wave which is traveling in the z direction. Okay, and rotational symmetry guarantees that every other wave is the same. You just have to rotate it to the z direction to see the behavior. And so k mu is going to be k, 0, 0, k. And so every other wave is related by a rotation. Okay, so there's no need to consider a completely general k. Let's put it in the z direction. And so now let's just look. Of course, that implies if k upstairs is this, then k downstairs, I've got to reverse the zero component. And now let's write out this equation. K mu epsilon mu nu is 1 half k nu epsilon mu mu. Okay, so if nu equals 0, this equation reads k epsilon 0, 0 plus epsilon 3, 0 is minus 1 half k minus epsilon 0, 0 plus epsilon 1, 1 plus epsilon 2, 2 plus epsilon 3, 3. Nu equals 3 reads k epsilon 0 3 plus epsilon 3 3 is equal to plus 1 half k, and then the same thing. And then the other one's a little bit easier. Nu equals 1 k epsilon 0 1 plus epsilon 3 1 equals 0, and k epsilon 0 2 plus epsilon 3, 2 equals 0. Okay, so here are the four constraints imposed by the TT condition. And it's easy to solve these to eliminate some of the epsilons. So we see epsilon 0, 1 from this equation is minus epsilon 3, 1. And we see epsilon 0, 2 is minus epsilon 3, 2. And if I take these two equations, let's call this one A and this one B, then A plus B gives you epsilon 0, 3 is equal to minus a half epsilon 0, 0 plus epsilon 3, 3. And A minus B gives you epsilon 2, 2 is minus epsilon 1, 1. Okay, so we've succeeded, eliminated epsilon 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 3, and 2, 2. And we've got six free components remaining. So now, of course, we're going to use our harmonic coordinate transformations to reduce H, or to reduce epsilon even further. And so now we're going to say epsilon prime mu nu is epsilon mu nu plus k mu c nu plus k nu c mu. And of course, these transformations will preserve those conditions, so nothing's going to change. When we use these ones, those are still going to be valid. And this gives you epsilon 0, 0 prime is epsilon 0, 0 minus 2k c0. Epsilon prime 1, 3 is 1, 3 plus k c1. Epsilon prime 2, 3 is epsilon 2, 3 plus k c2. Epsilon prime 3, 3 is epsilon 3, 3 plus 2k c3. And then epsilon prime 1, 1 doesn't change, and neither does epsilon 1, 2. And so what we're going to do is to set these zero. So through a harmonic coordinate transformation, we are able to set these four components zero. Okay, using up C0, C1, C2, C3. When I've done that, if I go back to this formula, Everything on the right-hand side has been set 0, well, apart from the last one. The top three equations, the right-hand sides, have been set 0. So the left-hand sides will also be 0. And so in TT gauge, we can in fact, let me just see. I'm sure I said this quite right. So TT gauge means we impose 1 and we use this freedom and use harmonic coordinate transformation freedom to eliminate everything except we can eliminate all components except epsilon 1,1 and epsilon 1,2, and of course the TT condition, this condition we wrote down, H sigma nu comma sigma equals 1/2 H sigma sigma comma nu. This ensures that epsilon 2,2 is minus epsilon 1,1. So there are only two free functions left. Once we've imposed the gauge condition, this gauge condition, and used the harmonic coordinate freedom to eliminate all the other components. And so that, when we've done all that, that's usually what's called transverse traceless gauge. And if you think about these components, these are precisely the components, the spatial components of epsilon, perpendicular to the wave vector k. So just in like in electromagnetism, the degrees of freedom that cannot be gauged away are transverse to the propagation of the wave. It's just that the H has two indices instead of one. And so it's a tensor. So the waves are tensor in general relativity. The waves are described by a symmetric matrix in the space of transverse indices. So let us now understand those waves a little more, and I'll tell you why they're spin 2. So the degrees of freedom the remaining non-gauge degrees of freedom describe transverse tensor waves, which are spin 2. And why are they spin 2? Well, spin 2, spin, is by definition the way something transforms under the rotation group. Okay, so what you've got to do is take your waves, which are propagating in the, well, actually in the z direction, and now perform rotations which leave the z direction invariant. Those rotations are in the 1,2 plane. Okay, so let's perform a rotation about the z-axis. That's called the little group of the momentum of the wave. So any wave will have a form momentum, right? P naught and a vector P. You can always do rotations around that vector, which leave it invariant. And those rotations define the transformation properties of the wave. Under those rotations, define the helicity, or which is what we mean when we say something is spin 2. It's it's the eigenvalue under rotations about the momentum vector. So a rotation about the z-axis in the 1-2 direction, about the z-axis looks like the following. It transforms x into y and y into x, minus sine theta cos theta 1. So that's the rotation. We have our matrix here. 2-1, 2-2. And we have the same thing again, but transposed. So recall that xi prime is oij xj. That's the definition of a rotation. And so h prime ij will be oil hlm o jm. And then because of this funny business that this index is in the wrong place for this to be a matrix product, we rewrite this as O transpose MJ, and now it looks like a matrix product. So that's how tensors transform under rotations. And so you can work all this out. You can see how the epsilons transform, and you can show that you see, you're going to get cosine squared and cosine sine. So you're going to get trig functions with double the angle. And what you can show that is that if we define epsilon plus to be epsilon 1, 1 minus I epsilon 1, 2, and epsilon minus is epsilon 1, 1 plus I epsilon 1, 2, these transform as follows. Epsilon plus prime is e to the 2i theta epsilon plus, and epsilon minus prime is e to the minus 2i theta epsilon minus, i.e. as helicity plus or minus 2. Actually, that it's really as spin plus or minus 2. That's the SZ component of the spin. Components of a massless degree of freedom with helicity 2. Okay, so I'll just leave you to work out that algebra, that if I do this transformation law on the epsilon matrix and work out how epsilon 1, 1 and epsilon plus and epsilon minus transform, they transform very simply. And this is actually guaranteed. There's a theorem in group theory that any abelian group has only one dimensional irreducible representations. So you're guaranteed that this is an abelian group, the group of rotations around the z direction. You're guaranteed that whenever you transform anything under this abelian group, you can break up the group matrices, the matrices representing the group. By choosing the right basis, you can block diagonalize them, and the diagonal elements are one-dimensional. So this is always guaranteed. Providing your theory and your object is rotational invariant, you're guaranteed that things will always break up into eigenvalues of the rotation, eigenvectors of rotations, which transform just with phases. So this is true for any rotational invariant equation you might write down. If we do the same thing for electromagnetism, E and M, then we will discover that the vector potential is the sum of some polarization tensors and we end up with epsilon plus being epsilon 1 minus I epsilon 2 and epsilon minus. So this is in Lorentz gauge plus gauging away epsilon naught and epsilon 3. So all you're left with is epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And if you make these two combinations, then you find epsilon plus prime is e to the I theta epsilon plus, and epsilon minus prime is e to the minus I theta epsilon minus. So those are the two spin states of the photon. They have spin 1 and spin minus 1, and classically they correspond to circularly polarized waves. If all I have in electromagnetism is epsilon plus, and if epsilon minus is 0, and I go back and plug this into the Maxwell, the formula for A, and then calculate the field strength, I'm going to discover I have a circularly polarized wave whose spin, if you think about the spin, it's along the z axis. And the epsilon minus will have a spin in the opposite direction. And it's the same thing with gravitational waves, except that the spin is 2. And can't help mentioning a nice thing about string theory. So the photon has spin 1. In fact, I think it said it. Sorry, I think I said it the wrong way around. This should be the helicity plus or minus 2 components with spin 2. Sorry. Helicity is this eigenvalue that appears in the rotation matrix. The photon has spin 1, and it has helicity plus or minus 1. The graviton has spin 2 and helicity plus or minus 2. And the way this works in string theory is rather beautiful, that, you know, in string theory, the basic degree of freedom is a string. And so you can just draw a picture of the photon. A photon occurs in an open string theory, in a theory with strings which have ends. And a photon looks like a little piece of string. In open string theory, the ends of the string have to move at the speed of light. Okay, this follows from the variational principle that you discover it's got these ends which have to move at the speed of light. And so the way you get a photon is you have a little rod of string which just spins around some axis, and it propagates in a perpendicular direction. This follows from the string equations. And so it can spin this way, or it can spin the other way. And those are the two helicity states of the massless state with spin one in string theory. That's what it looks like. By the way, the diagram in Carroll's book is completely wrong on this. He has some totally different picture, which is just wrong. But the graviton, so how do I make a spin two object? A spin two object in string theory. Okay, so the open string is a little rod with two ends. How could I get something with twice the spin? A fundamental degrees of freedom with twice the spin. It's very obvious from the picture. So a clue is that graviton only occurs in closed string theories. What do you do? How do I make a closed string from an open string? Pardon? I could try to bend it, but I can do something even simpler. I could try to bend this and put the two ends together, but I can do something even simpler. Okay, why don't I just put another one next to it? Okay, and join the ends. Okay, well, that's a closed string, and it spins end over end. It's still a solution of the closed string equations of motion. Now, doesn't have any ends. It's still a solution of the closed string equations of motion. It has double the spin, obviously, spin two. Okay, so that's how string theory gives you the graviton. And you might say this is a stupid little picture, but it immediately tells you that when I want to calculate graviton scattering amplitudes, maybe what I should do is take photon scattering amplitudes and square them. Because what is a graviton? It's just, a graviton's made out of two photons. And this is actually a very, very powerful formula. So all the results in graviton scattering of the last 5 years are basically built on this fact that graviton amplitudes factorize into photon scattering amplitudes. So it's actually a very, very deep thing, and it's quite interesting. But who knows if string theory is right? Okay, it's certainly cute, but that doesn't make it right. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition. Gonna be right, you've got to be cute, but doesn't guarantee you're right. Okay, so that's the discussion of gravitational waves. So this is string theory. The question you should have asked me is, why the hell is this massless? Because surely a string has a mass. I mean, there's some energy in that string. Surely there's some rest mass. You know, if this little piece of chalk was sitting here and spinning around, doesn't really look like a photon, because a photon would be zipping along at the speed of light. Okay, a piece of string isn't. And the reason it turns out to be massless is a quantum effect. So if you just take a classical spinning piece of string, it can sit here in the room. But when you quantize string theory, it turns out that's not allowed. You can have a spinning string, but it's got to be zipping along at the speed of light. And that's forced on you by something called the Virasoro conditions, which are quantum. Okay, so I think we'll take a break and come back in 5 minutes, and we'll do gravitational wave radiation. Sure.
How does this picture show that it's a spin to opening?
Well, there are only two ways it can go. It can go this way, or it can go that way.
What about the photon?
Why is it spin one? Yeah, it can only go this way or that way. The special thing about, so normally in quantum mechanics, if a particle has spin one, you can say SZ can be one, zero, or minus one. The special thing in relativity is the spin zero is not allowed when you have a massless particle. So basically in relativity, a spin one object can have SZ equal to one or minus one, that's it. Now, so in string theory, you just discover these two solutions. It can go this way or that way. And you say, well, they're two states. They must be the same by rotational symmetry. There's nothing really distinguishing them. And so that it must be spin one.
But why does it have to stay in the spin? Why can't
it go? It can go both ways. It has two possibilities for the spin.
Yeah. Okay.
Just because it has two possibilities, you say it must be spin one. You don't know the normalization, right? But then you discover, oh, there's this particle that obviously has twice the spin, only exists in a closed string theory. And so then you say, well, the graviton must, you know, these must be the photon and graviton. One has double the spin of the other.
So what I'm having trouble seeing is, in this picture, how does the...
It's just twice the mass, So spin is angular momentum. If I take an object and I double it, it's got double the angular momentum. Okay, it's only a classical picture, but it's correct. That's exactly how the math works. So in the one case, you quantize an open string, in the other case, you quantize a closed string, and then you go through a lot of math and blah, 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 and at the end of the day, it's double the spin. So it shouldn't be a surprise.
I had a question about Einstein's equations.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Is there a way to see that if you're given like an arbitrary interdualism tensor to solve Einstein's equations, the metric you get will be Lorentz? How do you know the metric?
Oh,
we'll have a signature.
Because signature is a topological thing. In other words, you can't change the signature without going through a singularity. So the basic assumption in Einstein's theory is this matrix G mu nu is invertible, right? It's invertible. And if it fails to be invertible, that's a singularity. The whole theory breaks down. When we defined the Riemann tensor, you know, we kept raising the metric indices. None of those formulae work if G inverse doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's fine, but...
So if we've got a metric with some signature, minus plus plus plus, that's the sign of the eigenvalues, and if one of those eigenvalues flipped sign, so it went to minus minus plus plus, inevitably I have to have a singularity.
Okay.
Then you just say the theory broken down, so I can't describe it.
But you need the extra fact that eta is always a solution to know that.
No.
How do you know it's going to have a Lorentzian metric then? All you said was that it has a constant.
This is by definition. So when I look for solutions of Einstein equations, I'm only interested in metrics with minus, plus, 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 by definition.
So it's not some property?
No. It's not implied by the equation. So in fact, there are lots of solutions to the equation with plus, 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 plus.
Riemannian
geometry has lots of solutions. So for example, if I take R mu nu equals zero, and I say signatures plus, 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 and I look for spherically symmetric solutions, I find the black hole, what's called the Euclidean section of the black hole. It is a solution to that equation, but it's Euclidean because it's plus, 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 plus.
Also, I think you kind of preempted another question I was going to ask, was that if you generally have a metric which the components vary space-time, how do you know the...
As I said, the only way to change singularity to go through to change signatures to go through singularity.
That's not obvious to me. Why is that true?
Because it's all by definition. So G mu nu better exist.
Yeah. I mean, I can easily come up with a matrix, which...
Well, okay, so think about it this way. Okay, so Gmnu is some matrix, right? Lambda 1, lambda, I guess lambda 0, 1, 2, lambda 3. It has some eigenvalues. Let's go to a coordinate frame in which G really is equal to this. Okay? Now, imagine we're going to change the sign of one of these eigenvalues at that point in space-time, or in that neighborhood.
I'm saying if you move in space-time.
Yeah, yeah.
So not at a point.
Okay.
By changing basis, you can't change the sign.
Yeah,
it's not
okay.
Clear that if you let time run or you move from here to there.
The signature of the eigenvalues is a topological invariant.
Yeah, it's not clear to me, I guess.
Let me think if I can.
You can have continuous and sign change. That doesn't explain anything.
No, they have to pass.
So you say there's something special about zero. You see, if the signature changes, well, let's think about the eigenvalues. Right? So these are always well-defined. So these eigenvalues are functions of space-time.
Okay.
Right? So at every point in space-time, I just calculate the eigenvalues of the metric. And I'm going to find in some big region, you know, it's minus plus plus plus.
Yeah, okay, I think that's...
To go from here to there, they've got to change sign, so one of them has to hit zero.
Okay.
On that surface, the metric isn't invertible anymore. So when you calculate things like the Ricci tensor, it's going to be infinity on that surface, generically, because it involves G inverse. But in any case, differential geometry breaks down on that surface. So it's a very appealing idea. There was a paper by Andrei Sakharov, who's one of the most creative physicists in the 60s and 70s, a famous Russian dissident. And he wrote a very nice paper on signature change, what it should be possible in GR. But you have to, momentarily depart from the hypotheses of Riemannian geometry or pseudo-Riemannian geometry. It's a related question whether the Big Bang was the beginning or not. So Big Bang is a singularity. Certainly, everything breaks down. The metric actually vanishes. The whole metric vanishes. All four eigenvalues vanish on the initial singularity. And can you go through? And I actually believe you can. But to show it is kind of tricky. So, for example, if you take a radiation, I may talk about this next week. If you take a radiation-dominated flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, this is the metric. Okay, where T is the time coordinate. So it's like Minkowski, but dt squared plus dx squared. This is the line element. Obviously, it vanishes, but it sort of vanishes in a very beautiful way. It just bounces. So for any positive t or any negative t, this is absolutely fine. T equals zero, there's this space-like surface on which the metric vanishes. It vanishes at one instant. Now you say, is that a good metric? It's pretty good. And the real way you see it's quite a good metric is by considering its analytic continuation. So you go to the complex t-plane. You say, on the real t-axis, it vanished at a point. But it's absolutely well-defined everywhere away from that point. And the continuation is totally unique. This is a unique function, which is analytic, agrees with the incoming metric, and it describes a bouncing universe. So that's actually the realistic metric of the early universe that we know about. So now you have to decide, well, was this point the beginning of time? Or am I allowed to say that GR is really only an approximation, and I'm allowed to use slightly complex solutions? If I take that point of view, there's no question the Big Bang was a bounce. And there was a contracting radiation-dominated universe before the Big Bang. And then you can take this further. You can say, okay, well, that's the approximate smooth background. Let me consider gravitational waves and everything else propagating on top of this. Turns out they all have beautiful properties. Everything has a unique continuation and you can do calculations and so on and so forth. But we still don't know if that singularity was the beginning or not. No, because
the overall factor doesn't really matter, right? But I mean, the relative sign will change. TV has a complex.
When the metric is complex, the eigenvalues are no longer real.
Okay,
so they're complex, and they're generically non-zero.
You're right.
And it's quite free when the eigenvalues are complex. There's no problem in going from positive to negative without going through zero.
Yeah, exactly. That's a powerful point, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's start again. Let's save it till after. Okay. So sorry, I got distracted. Let's do gravitational radiation. So this is what we're going to see in the next 5 years. We're going to detect these waves. Let us let's say maybe in harmonic gauge. Yeah, I think I'm going to use that terminology. Harmonic gauge is when I close box X mu is zero. TT gauge is when I furthermore eliminate everything but the transverse waves. So in harmonic gauge, we have this equation, R mu nu is minus 1/2 box H mu nu. The box is just the Minkowski box. And that, of course, is equal to 8 pi G T mu nu minus 1/2 eta mu nu T lambda lambda. OK, so here I'm interested in studying not just the waves, but how they're produced. And the way the waves are produced is you have some localized source of stress energy on the right-hand side, and it's going to move around. And as it moves around, it's going to radiate H. And we're going to calculate the radiation using this formula. Of course, outside of the source, I can ignore the source, and the waves will just satisfy the same equation we've already studied. Okay, so we call this the source. And we're going to assume it is localized in space. So this is going to be a pair of neutron stars or a neutron star black hole. Black hole is tricky because you have to understand what these source terms are. But if we just deal with matter sources, it's a little easier. We're allowed to, you see I put eta here. Because I'm working to linear order in H, so we assume H mu nu is much less than 1. We assume, we linearize in T mu nu. Let me see, do I want to say that? Yeah, so what's the right way of saying this? Box H goes like G T. So the left and the right hand sides of this equation have to be the same order, in other words, linear order. And so we can ignore H mu nu's on the RHS since they would be higher order. Okay, so the way to think about it, I've got some energy momentum moving around in Minkowski space. Oh, sorry, I've got some energy momentum moving around. It creates a weak gravitational field. And So when I solve the Einstein equations, I treat the space-time around the source as if it's Minkowski space. All right, just calculate the motion of the stuff as if it was in Minkowski space and use that as a source of H. Now, if I do that, I'm going to get an H, which is small by assumption. And now I could go back and substitute that, plug that H back into the right-hand side. That would be a correction to the right-hand side. And if this initial calculation gives a small number, that correction is going to be even smaller. So that's the idea of linearized gravity. It's actually extremely tricky to justify rigorously, okay? And actually never has been justified rigorously, but it's also quite plausible that it's correct. So I'm going to assume. So this is called. So in other words, i.e., replace the metric by metric on the RHS by eta mu nu. This is called linearized gravity. Now, we defined h bar mu nu, which was h mu nu minus 1 half eta mu nu h lambda lambda. And it follows from this equation that that h bar mu nu, so let's call that star. So star implies that h bar mu nu is equal to, I've gone a slightly long way around, which was unnecessary. H bar mu nu is, box h bar mu nu is equal to minus 16 pi g t mu nu. Okay, so this is just the familiar thing. This is completely equivalent of saying that g mu nu, the Einstein tensor, is minus 1 half box h bar mu nu. And so I could have just said that. G mu nu is minus 1 half box h mu nu. That is equal to 8 pi g t mu nu. And then I get this equation. So I guess that's the other way of thinking about h-bar, is it's really just the perturbation in the box h-bar is the perturbation in the Einstein tensor, up to a factor of a half. Well, this is rather an easy equation to solve, because it's exactly the equation you get in electrodynamics. And so the solution is for a localized source, t mu nu, the solution is h mu nu bar equals minus 4g integral d3x prime over x minus x prime times the source evaluated at the retarded time. X prime. I've set C equals 1 just to keep things simple. Yeah, you'll note it. I've dropped the C to the 4th on the right-hand side and so on and so forth. It's easy enough to put the C's back in, but I'm going to drop them from now on. So this solution is the standard solution in electrodynamics. These are called the Leonhard-Lichert potentials. If you have a moving source in electrodynamics, it's telling you the very obvious thing that the source influencing this h mu nu at a time t and place x, the source is, if this is t and this is x, then a source that's moving around here creates a disturbance which travels at the speed of light. And so basically the disturbance you get at a given space-time point is given by whatever the is determined by whatever the source was doing at a time, an effective time, given by your current time minus the time it took for the disturbance to travel to you, which is just the distance away from you. So that's the solution. Actually, this is only true in three dimensions. It's an interesting fact that if you look at the Green's function for this propagation in different numbers of dimensions, they don't have this property. They're not uniquely localized. In two dimensions, even in two dimensions, the influence doesn't travel strictly along the light cone, which is what this is doing. In two dimensions, it's a little bit broader, that you actually depend on stuff inside your light cone, even with a massless field. But it does work in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And so this is CF Leonhard-Lichert. Potentials M, E, and M. So that's the solution. It's called the retarded solution. This minus sign here means retarded. That is imposing the fact that we only care about what happened in our past. We don't have waves propagating back to us from the future. This is a fundamental fact about the world, which we don't quite understand. Okay, but it involves causality. So the choice of sign here was very important, and it's an experimental fact about the world that we do not receive radiation from the future, only from the past. So let's now expand in mod x prime over x. So let me just draw a vector indicating that. Let's see. So this is I've got some source here. Okay. This is the vector x prime I'm going to integrate over. I am sitting at so let's choose our origin to be in the middle, somewhere in the middle of the source. This is the distance to me, or the vector to me. I'm watching the source. And the strength of radiation depends like 1 over, or the metric perturbation goes like 1 over r. This vector is, of course, x minus x prime. And so the strength of the h goes like 1 over r, just like the usual potentials in electrostatics, for example. And then, again, this distance determines the time at which I'm sensitive to in the source. Okay, so I'm going to integrate over x prime assuming x, the magnitude of this, is much bigger than the magnitude of that. Okay, i.e., we are far from the source. And so what I get is that h bar mu nu is approximately 4g over r. I just pull this factor out of the integral. You see mod, think about square root of x minus x prime squared. That's what mod x minus x prime is. And rewrite this as r, pull that out, root 1 minus 2 x dot x prime over r plus x prime squared over r squared. And then expand these quantities in the magnitude of x prime over r. R here is equal to mod x. So that's equal to r times 1 minus x dot x prime, that should be an r squared, I presume. R squared, etc. So that gives you the usual multipole expansion. But we're just taking the leading term, the 1 over r behavior. The higher terms will go, you see each of these terms, the x prime is going to be determined by the size of the source, and it's always divided by r. So this is really an expansion in L over r, if the source size is L. So this is expansion in L over r, and the leading term is just the 1 over r. So what we get is d3x prime, and then t mu nu t minus r x prime. So what I've done is drop this x prime term completely in the argument of t. And the reason for doing that is that that's a small perturbation to this quantity. You see this x prime term is down relative to the leading term by 1 power of r. And that's OK, providing the source doesn't have huge derivatives. If the source only varies on the scale L, then that's reasonable. So this is OK if the source varies only on the scale L. So this is almost the answer we want, but we can now simplify things. Yeah.
Is that equal or multiplication?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Multiplication. Sorry. Yes, thank you. So now it implies, this equation implies that h bar kl goes like g over r integral t kl. These are the spatial indices. And if I'm interested in gravitational radiation, I'm going to be interested in the transverse part of h. transverse tracers part of H, and which is sourced by the space-like components, spatial components of T. And so I want to, I'll give you one identity, and then we will quit. There's a nice identity. This is D3X. In fact, integral D3X of TKL of T and X is equal to 1/2 integral, one half d2 by dt squared of integral d3x xk xl t naught naught. Okay, so that's a very nice identity, which is true for any stress energy tensor which is conserved. It's all it relies on. Okay, for any T mu nu obeying D mu, T mu nu equals zero. So let's prove that. I'm going to ignore the fact that there's an argument of minus R in here. I just ignore that, and we'll come back and justify it later. In fact, it doesn't change the argument at all. It just messes up the algebra. But let's just drop the R from the argument there for the moment. So how do I prove that? Well, the right-hand side, you see, I can bring one of these time derivatives inside. And so that's 1/2. Let's bring one of them inside and use the fact that d naught t naught naught is minus di t naught naught, t I naught. OK, so I can replace this with a spatial derivative, d naught of it with a spatial derivative. And then I bring the other derivative inside, and d naught of t I naught is equal to minus dj t I j. These are precisely the four components of this equation. So I use the first derivative to convert this into a t I j, and I use the second time derivative to convert it into a t I j. And what I get is 1/2 dn dm tnm xk xl d3x. Okay, I got two minus signs, which gives me a plus. And now I just integrate by parts in space. So I get minus 1/2 integral d3x. This derivative I can put over here. And so I get dm tnm. Differentiating this with respect to n gives me delta k n x l plus delta l n x k. And so now I can integrate by parts again with space, with respect to space. And I get TNM delta KN delta LM plus delta LN delta KM. And now I can use up those deltas to just get 1/2. So I just get the whole integral of D3X of TKL. Okay, so that proves the result. And so what we see is that h bar kl is equal to minus 2 g over r. Let me just see. Yeah, because I had a half here. Just worried about the sign. Why did I put a sign? A minus. d2 dt squared integral d3x t00. T to T minus R. Let me just check the sign. Oh, yeah, I lost the sign here, didn't I? This should be, this was minus. Okay, so this is the result, is that I take my stress tensor at t and x prime, and integrated over space, multiply with x prime k, x prime l. This is related to the quadrupole moment. You know, the monopole moment is if I just integrate the function. Dipole is if it's with 1 power of x prime. Quadrupole is 2 powers of x prime. So this is related to the quadrupole moment, and I take 2 time derivatives of that quadrupole moment. And then after I've done all that, I just replace t with t minus r. Okay? Now that's actually perfectly correct, because you see this r here doesn't depend on x prime. So there's nothing wrong with all of this calculation. I just replace t with t minus r. It's just easier to, you know, not to bother with putting it in here. So I could have actually put t minus r in here. It'd still be true, because that has nothing to do with the integration. Maybe I should distinguish them by priming all these guys. R is not a function of x prime to first order in x prime over x. Okay, so you already get the result that the metric perturbation created by moving some energy around is related to the acceleration of that energy. That's kind of obvious, because you know if I just translated some energy, I could always go to the rest frame of that energy, and it's not going to do anything, because it would just be sitting at rest. So nothing could be doing anything. If it's just sitting at rest, it can't be radiating gravitational waves. So the only way I'm going to get gravitational waves is if I accelerate the source. So you accelerate the source, and then you might have guessed that because the gravitational wave is spin 2, it's going to respond only to the quadrupole moment. And in fact, this is a totally general result, that if I have a scalar field with no indices, it responds to the monopole moment of the source. If I have a vector index, like in electromagnetism, it responds to the dipole moment of the source. And if I have a tensor like H, it responds to the quadrupole moment. Equivalently, you can say the following, that a scalar would have a source J with no indices. There's no conservation law associated with this source. In electromagnetism, we have a source like this with 4 components, right? There is a conservation law associated with this equation. That conservation law ensures there's no radiation of at the monopole. There's no radiation of the monopole. That the monopole, sorry, say it differently. The monopole moment of J is the total charge, right? It's integral d3x of J naught. That is conserved. So you cannot change the monopole moment in the source for electromagnetism. So obviously you can't radiate. If you're not allowed to change it, you can't radiate from a changing monopole. You're just not allowed to change the monopole. In GR, we have an equation like box H goes like T mu nu. And here I've got two sets of conservation laws. This one conserves energy, this conserves momentum. That ends up telling you that you can't change the monopole of the source, that would be the energy. You can't change the dipole of the source, that would be the momentum. Momentum is conserved, I can't change it. And therefore, the only way I can radiate is from the quadrupole, changing quadrupole moment. And it has to be accelerating rather than moving. It's just the first derivative. Like I said, you can go into the rest frame and it couldn't be radiating. So this is really the only thing it could be. Everything else is dimensions and a factor of two. Okay, so next time we will take this formula for the radiation of the linearized wave. We're going to calculate the energy carried by those waves and discuss what the hell that means, that gravitational waves are the metric. Why am I calling them energy? Well, you can. You're allowed to take metric perturbations and reinterpret them as energy. So these gravitational waves carry energy. And then in the case of the binary pulsar, it was two neutron stars orbiting each other. They emit this gravitational waves at a significant rate. And that resulted in Hulse and Taylor winning the Nobel Prize because they took the formula we will derive next time and just compared it to the binary pulsar. And it fits perfectly to within a fraction of a percent. And so we know gravitational waves exist. At least the Nobel Prize Committee has already recognized them, but only in pulsars. And what's new about the next 5 years is we're going to detect them on Earth directly. Okay, any last questions? Yes.
Like, isn't
that
something still part of 4D?
If there's a current
going out, like we determine the boundary.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I think that's true. So the point is that if I have a localized source, right, what I have in GR are four conserved quantities. I've got integral d3x t naught naught is constant. That's the energy, right? If the source is localized. When I say the source is localized, by definition, there's nothing traveling out at infinity. Then there's no monopole. But you're right. If there was a flux in the source, then, of course, this is changing. And I should expect monopole radiation in H. And actually, it's pretty easy to see what it will be. Because you remember that H naught naught goes like 2gm over r c squared, plus or minus. I mean, that's just for a normal, massive, spherically symmetric object. It has to go like this. If you radiate stuff, this mass is going to change. And that will change h naught naught. And so you will get a time-varying gravitational field. So when I solve this equation in that circumstance, it should be reflected in the solution. And that the change will be this monopole that you're talking about. So indeed, it's there. In fact, this relates to this memory effect. Okay, so the memory effect is saying, see, this formula is very inexact. It ignores metric perturbations in the source. And in fact, it is more complicated. There are nonlinear effects of the H in the source, and those end up causing changes in the long-range metric, which you can roughly speaking think of as just this mass changing, and H will change. That is not reflected in the acceleration of an object. It's reflected in the position. So I'm sitting here. This gravitational wave comes past. My position changes. And I'm sitting somewhere else. That's called the memory effect. You're still in flat space. All that happens is you translated flat space by some amount. And that's a memory effect. It's a global effect. You cannot see the consequence locally at all. But there are multiple copies of flat space, is another way of saying it. And if I distribute a set of particles, and I push a gravitational wave through, those particles will have moved. And that's a new copy of flat space. And this is the assertion people are making, that actually that's where the information in the black hole has gone. It's into something we would normally consider as just being a gauge transformation, just a coordinate change of coordinates. But actually, it can be there in GR. Yeah?
When we measure the gravitational wave experimentally, which quantity is directly measured?
Yeah, it's a good question. So depends on the experiment. So, for example, in LIGO, they have pendulums, which are hanging. And let's see. So basically, you have these two pendulums separated by a kilometer. And they bounce light waves back and forth to measure the distance between the two pendulums. So now the gravitational wave comes past. If it's traveling this way, it's transverse. So it's going to squeeze these pendulums together. And then they will start oscillating. And so all it's going to, it doesn't actually measure the memory effect because the masses get restored to the same proper length between them. To see the memory effect, you need to see that they shift. And so it's not optimized for that at all. It's optimized just to see the passage of the wave form. And essentially, it's tuned to waves of a particular wavelength, which is given by the size of the system. So different experiments measure different things. They're measuring different polarizations. They're measuring different waveforms. They're tuned to different wavelengths. So each experiment is different. OK, I think I better leave.